Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Podcast. I'm Deidre Tyler, host. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Sharon D. Wright Austin, author and editor of Political Black Girl Magic, The Elections and Governance of Black Female Mayors. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. I wonder if you could start by saying a few words about yourself and how you got started on this project.
Well, my name is Sharon Austin, and I am a professor of political science at the University of Florida. I served as director of the African American Studies program for 8 years at the University of Florida. I've been teaching there since 2021. I started my career in academia when I was still in grad school back in 1992 at the University of Louisville, and then I went to University of Missouri, Columbia, in the Department of Political Science and also the Department of Black Studies. And after that, I spent a year as a visiting scholar at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and I came to Florida, and I've been here ever since 2001. But to tell you about the project, I got an idea for this project. I've studied mayors all throughout my career, especially Black mayors. And I got the idea for this project back in 2017 when I saw an article in Essence magazine about the year of the Black woman mayor. It talked about the Black women who were being elected in larger cities. There had been a few Black female mayors before, but most of them had served in smaller cities or smaller towns. But in this article, it talked about mayors of large cities. And that gave me an idea to look into Black women because I've always looked at Black mayors looking at Black men. And then during the pandemic, I was just talking to some friends of mine on social media, and we were just saying, oh, wow, wouldn't that be nice if we could have like a book on that? I don't think there ever has been one specifically that looks at Black women. And I was like, yeah, it would be nice. And that's how I just got the idea. Why don't I just put together a book? And I sent out an email, and several of my friends volunteered to do chapters. And then Temple University Press, as soon as I sent the email, with the abstract, asking people to send abstracts for chapters, they immediately contacted me and told me that they were interested in possibly giving me an advance contract. And I was shocked at that. They were moving really quickly, and they would have just been wonderful to work with. So that's how we got the idea, and that's how we put it all together.
Great. Well, you started in chapter one telling us about the 1970s and the first during that time period. Tell us about that time period. What were some of the breakthroughs?
During that time period in the 1970s, the first Black mayors had been elected in large cities beginning in 1967 in Cleveland and Gary, Indiana. And then in the early 1970s, in 1973, you saw elections of Black mayors in cities like Detroit and Atlanta. But the first Black female mayors were elected during that time period as well. And most people have never heard of women like Doris Davis and Compton, Ellen Foley, and most people have never heard of these women who were elected like in the early 1970s, Doris Davis. And so they were elected during a time period in which it was called a theory called the Hollow Prize. The belief was that once a Black mayor was elected in a city, that city had gone through so much of an economic downturn that usually the city was a hollow prize. Yes, you were elected mayor, but you were mayor of a poor city. And that was, I guess, the case in a city like Compton, because during this time period in the early 70s, a lot of cities were experiencing white flight, middle class flight. A lot of people were moving out because integration was taking place more rapidly in white areas. And as a result, some people in the white community didn't like the fact that they were living in neighborhoods with black people. And so they were moving out of the cities. And that led to a lot of poverty. Crime rates were increasing. So there were a lot of problems, especially during later years in the 1980s with cuts in federal funding to cities. So that kind of exacerbated problems during the 80s. But during the 70s, cities were dealing with those types of problems. And these were women who had been involved in their community for many years. And they decided to just run for mayor. They were just thinking that, you know, why not me? I mean, Doris Davis in Taft, Oklahoma, was just basically saying that she was a single mom. She didn't have a lot of money, but she was in a small, pretty much all black community. And she decided to run for mayor, and eventually she won. So those were the types of things that were happening in cities when women decided that they were no longer going to be in the background, that usually women had been the organizers and there had always been a male leader at the forefront. But now women were deciding that they too were going to run for mayor and they too were going to run for various political offices. And because of the leadership that they had exhibited in their communities, they were able to win.
Now, you talk about the common threads that many of these women share. Tell us about these common threads and the symbolic significance.
Well, I think one thing that I was really impressed by when I was doing the research on all the women that we looked at in the book, a lot of them were members of sororities, of you know, historically black sororities. I found that I think the majority of women who've served in recent years have been members of Delta Sigma Theta, but they also were members of Alpha Kappa Alpha, Zeta Phi Beta. So they were members of sororities, and they had gotten involved in campus service and community service while they were in college. And that continued after they graduated. And that led many of them to work in government service. And in other cases, even if they didn't work in government service, that led many of them to work, volunteer for political campaigns, to work with politicians in cities, and to later become very involved in their communities and later to run for mayor. So I found that was one of the things that I found really interesting. And I found also that these black women tend to be more educated than the average mayors. All of the women that we studied in the book have at least a bachelor's degree. Many of them have law degrees, have master's degrees. Some of them even have MDs, medical doctors, PhDs. There was only one woman, and that was Victoria Woodard in Tacoma, Washington, who didn't have a bachelor's degree at the time. Now, she since has earned one, but that was because right after high school, she immediately went into the Army, and she had a very distinguished military career, and she later earned her bachelor's degree while she was in the military. But all the other women, they tend to be a lot more educated than the average mayors in cities, and I found that to be interesting as well. But also, many of them had careers as lawyers in community development, and all of them in some way were involved in their community extensively before they decided to run for mayor. So those were just some of the things that they had in common.
Now, tell the audience about the specific hurdles that some of the women had to undergo, like the black male opposition.
Right. They did have to undergo opposition from black men. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we found interesting was the women that weren't reelected, all of them lost to a man, not necessarily a black man, but they all lost to a man. Usually it was a case in which a male candidate was running against them and focusing on crime and public safety and trying to portray them as being weak on protecting their cities and on protecting crime and public safety. And so I think that might have some type of gendered aspect to it, in the sense that maybe people might think that a man is a more appropriate person to serve as mayor in a city. He is better at addressing crime, and that's certainly not true, but maybe that's one of the misconceptions. But I found that to be interesting. And then also you had women who would just openly speak out about the sexism that they dealt with from men of all races. In some cases, you had women like Karen Weaver in Gary, Indiana, who talked about the fact that the water crisis, and she was the mayor of Flint. And she talked about the fact that the water crisis had happened before she was even elected in Flint, Michigan. But yet once she was in office, people expected her to solve the problems overnight. And there even is a quote that's like a part of the chapter, title of the chapter on Flint, Michigan, in which she talks about the fact that they want to get this, let this little girl come in and clean everything up. And she talked about the sexism that she faced. In many cases, these would be women who would have men who would criticize them, because these would be men who planned to run against them when they went up for re-election. So that was a common theme that I noticed as well. And also Lori Lightfoot in Chicago, she was very outspoken about the sexism and the racism that she encountered during the time that she was the one term that she served as mayor of Chicago. So for Black women, race is an issue. And I would say for most of the women, they would pretty much say that race is probably a larger problem for them, racism, than sexism. But sexism is an issue too. And unfortunately in the Black community, it's not something that we like to talk about, because in the Black community, sometimes we think, oh, it's divisive to talk about sexism, but there are some problems that exist. And some of these women talked about the problems that they dealt with because of their gender.
Absolutely. What about the stereotype that a lot of people have of Black women, the angry Black female? Tell us about that and how they were dealing with that.
Right. A lot of the women talked about that as well. The angry Black woman stereotype is one. Even when Michelle Obama was first lady, even she had to deal with it. I think most Black women, regardless of what you do for a living or where you live or where you went to school or if you went to school, we all have to deal with that angry Black woman stereotype. I think women generally are expected to not really to fight back or not to really speak openly. There are things that men can say that if a woman said the same thing, she'd be viewed in a totally different way. She would receive a lot more criticism. And for Black women, I would think it's even worse, because these are women who, when they would speak out about the problems, when they would respond to the criticism, when they would use language that was similar even to language that maybe men had been using for years, they would be seen as being like an angry Black woman. Like the mayor of New Orleans, LaToya Cantrell, oftentimes talked about the way that she was stereotyped in that way. And I think most of the women in the book were stereotyped in that way, because if you are the leader of a city, if you're the mayor of a city, you have to have a very assertive personality. You cannot be a meek and timid woman. You have to be a fighter. And that's why the people elect you, because they want you to be the kind of really assertive woman who's a fighter. But yet in the case of these women that I study in this book, these Black women, when they are assertive and when they provide that type of strong, dominant leadership, sometimes the people are taken aback and they find it to be off-putting, and they see it as if, oh, you know, she's just an angry Black woman, she's just a complainer. When they talk about racism, the idea is that, oh, it's not race, she's just not doing a good enough job, she's just a race baiter. When they talk about sexism, they're seen as being weak, she's just using her gender as an excuse, she's just a whiner. So it's like a no-win situation. And that's just something that for any woman in any position, but especially if you're in any political position, you pretty much have to know that you have to expect this. That is something that's going to happen.
Now, you talk about the unique problems that many of the Black women mayors had to deal with. Tell us about their unique problems and working with the city council.
Yeah, they had problems. I think any mayor would have problems. They have to make sure they have a good relationship with the members of the city council. And that's very difficult to do, because, as I said, some of the members of the city council are planning to run against you when your term is up. And so they kind of want to try to undermine you in some ways. They don't want to provide you with support. And then even with the city council, sometimes you have a racial aspect, because you have a Black female mayor, you have members of the city council who are of other races, you have white men and women who don't support you, and there might be some type of racial factor there. You have a gender issue, because you have some men who may not want a woman in a position of authority. They may not be accustomed to taking orders from a woman. You have those types of situations. So when you're elected as the mayor of a city, you have to be, I talk about this in one of my classes, you have to be a facilitator. You have to be a consensus builder. You have to be the kind of person who can get support from everyone on the city council. You have to get the support of the business community. You have to make sure you have a good relationship with law enforcement, especially with whoever your police commissioner is, or your chief of police. You have to make sure you have a good relationship with the communities, community activists. And that's really difficult because you have all these people who have all these different needs and different wants and different personalities. And you have to find a way to work with all of them. But it's a really, really difficult thing to do.
Now, in chapter three, you talked about the mayors in California. Tell us about how Ms. Warren was so successful in one of her California cities.
Right. In that chapter on California, I talk about two mayors. I talk about a former mayor of Compton, Aja Brown. And Compton has a history of electing Black female mayors because they were among one of the first cities to elect a Black female mayor. Aja Brown was a young she was in her early 30s when she was elected as mayor, and she's no longer mayor now, but I think that probably most people in Compton would say that she did a very good job in moving the city forward and in transforming the city's reputation. Compton is known for crime, for gang violence of the 90s, for gangster rap. It's known for those types of things, but she really did a lot to transform the city because of her government background. So I talk about Aja Brown, but I also talk about the only Black female Republican of a major city, and her name is Aquanetta Warren. She has been in office for several years now. There are no term limits in Fontana. So she's been in office now, I'm thinking this is her third term in office. And unlike the other women, many of these women represent cities that are predominantly white, but most of them represent cities that have large Black populations. But Aquanetta Warren is a Black female Republican. I guess she would call herself a fiscal conservative. She was born in Compton. She moved to Fontana. Fontana is not very far from Los Angeles. It's, I think you could refer to it as a relatively affluent city in San Bernardino County. And she represents a city that has probably about an 8% Black population. It may not even be that high. It's predominantly white, Hispanic, and Asian. She has a city council that is predominantly, I think it's all male. At the time that she was elected, at least it was, white and Hispanic and Asian men. And she has to deal with that type of environment where she's a Black woman who's a Republican, and she's dealing with people who are in an affluent community. So the city that she represents is different from the other cities represented by most of the Black women. And I think that people, because she's been reelected so many times, I think that people would say that she has done a good job in maintaining the prosperous nature of the city. It's been called one of the most prosperous cities in the country. She's brought in a lot of jobs. She's done a lot for the economy. She seems to be very popular. But of course, she has her critics, because I talk about the fact that there have been recall efforts because some of the progressives that live in her city don't agree with some of the things that she's done. Even they didn't like the fact that when Donald Trump was president, she went and she talked to him and she took a picture with him. And there was a picture of the two of them smiling and, you know, and talking to each other. And people were really outraged by that because they were like, how dare you, you know, take pictures with Donald Trump and be friends with him. But she was saying that I'm just trying to do what's best for my city. And if it means that this person is the president, whether we like it or not, and if it means that I have to talk to this person and deal with this person, then so be it. But it's really interesting because there have been so few Black female Republicans serving as mayor. I mentioned in the chapter that there have been some others, not very many, but even the few that have been in cities tend to have been in cities that were smaller. But there are, I guess, more Black women running as Republicans. But I also point out in the chapter that a lot of women who run as Republicans don't believe that the Republican Party gives them enough support when a Black woman does run, and even Black men feel the same way. But that is a really interesting chapter about Aquanetta Warren.
Now, chapter four, you go to Rochester, New York, and you talk about all of the successes of that mayor in terms of her training programs. Tell us about that.
Right. That was lovely, Warren. And that chapter was written by two of my colleagues, my good friend, Dr. Angela Lewis Maddox, who's at professor of political science at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and also Dr. Stephanie Pink Harper, who also is at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. And they did the research for that chapter on Lovely Warren. Unfortunately, she ended up leaving office because of a scandal and some other problems that she ran into. But during the time that she was in Rochester, she really did a lot to try to involve young people. She set up some really innovative programs. The theme of the book is economic development, and I talk about the fact that all of the mayors tried different economic development strategies, because that's usually what citizens are more concerned about, is the economy and jobs and those types of things. And she, of course, was concerned with those things. But because Rochester is an urban city like every other that has problems with crime and policing and other issues with, you know, youth development, she set up some really innovative programs for economic development. But she also wanted to make sure that she involved the youth, because of the idea that if you do something to involve young people in something, especially teenagers, involve them in a constructive activity, that'll be a good way of keeping them from getting into trouble, keeping them busy, keeping them preoccupied, giving them something to look forward to. And so that is something that my friends Angela and Stephanie wrote about in the chapter on Rochester.
In chapter 5, you go to the Black females in Florida, and there were many. Tell us about them.
Yeah, one of the things that I like about this book that I was honored to be able to do is involve students, because I wrote some of the chapters with some of my undergraduate students. We have several undergraduate research programs here at the University of Florida, including in my department, the Junior Fellows. I was able to work with some undergraduate students that helped me to gather research, and they also helped me co-author the chapters on Louisiana and Michigan. And in this chapter on Florida, it was written by two of my students, Raven Timoney, who will be earning her PhD in May, and Kelly Richardson, who will be earning her PhD next year, and also another professor, Ashley Preston, who is now an assistant professor of history at Howard, but at the time that she wrote the chapter with Kelly and LaRaven, she was a lecturer in African American studies, and they did the chapter on Florida. Ashley Preston has done extensive work in Daytona Beach because she used to be a professor at Bethune-Cookman, and she's written books on Mary McLeod Bethune. And she also was the director of the Mary McLeod Bethune Museum at Bethune-Cookman. And so she wrote a chapter on a woman who passed away of cancer years ago, Yvonne Scarlett Golden. And she wrote about the fact that she was Mary McLeod Bethune's student and all of the things that she did as an older Black woman who grew up during and lived during segregation, who moved to San Francisco and worked there, and then later settled in Daytona Beach and ran for mayor. And unfortunately, she died of cancer several years ago. But in that chapter, they talk about some of the things that she was doing in Daytona Beach. And then Kelly and LaRaven talk about Broward County, which had a Black female mayor, Barbara Sharif, who was not only a Black woman, but also is a Muslim. And she was the mayor of Broward County, and they write about her experiences as a Black woman who also is a Muslim and has to deal with all the stereotypes that we have about Muslims in our society. And then also they write about mayors in Dania Beach, and they mention Sarasota, Florida, and also Lauderdale Lakes is where I think LaRaven focused. And that is a city that has a Black female mayor at the time of the writing of the article, a Black female vice mayor, and all of the members of the city council in Lauderdale Lakes, which is in South Florida, which is also in Broward County. All of them are Black females as well. And so they write about those three communities in the chapter on Florida.
In chapter 6, the Mississippi Delta mayors. Tell us about those mayors.
Right. That chapter was written by my good friend, Dr. Emmett Riley, who is president of the National Conference of Black Political Scientists and is also an associate professor and director of African American Studies at the University of the South. And he also is a political science professor there. And also one of my mentors, Minion Casey Morrison, who is a professor who we used to work together. He was sort of like my mentor when I was at the University of Missouri Columbia. And he now is at the University of Delaware in the Department of Political Science. And then the third author is Yvonne Jones, who at the time was at Mississippi Valley State. And so they wrote the chapter on the Mississippi Delta. And that chapter is really dear to me because my parents were born and raised in the Delta, and I have family who still live there. As a matter of fact, my second book was about the Mississippi Delta and politics there. And they write about the mayor at the time, Sherrill Perkins of Greenwood, Mississippi, and then also Unita Blackwell, who was a civil rights advocate, civil rights pioneer, who later became the mayor of Mayersville, Mississippi. And they write about just the dynamics of Mississippi being a state that has the largest Black population. And at one time, and probably still does have, more Black elected officials than any other state. But they wrote about the experiences of United Blackwell when she was becoming mayor of Mayersville, which is a small city. And then in Greenwood, the racial dynamics there, because you can't talk about Mississippi and not talk about race. And they talked about just some of the issues there. And I also mentioned another woman who had been mayor of a city of Holmes County, Mississippi, in another chapter. Her name is Yvonne Brown. And she was a Black female Republican mayor. And I mentioned her in the chapter on California. But that chapter is really interesting because when we think of mayors, we tend to think of cities. But in that chapter, they look at the mayors of like smaller towns and smaller cities and the dynamics of governing in the South and also of governing in a small town.
Now, you went on to Charlotte, North Carolina, and you talked about the Black woman mayor there. How does she deal with affordable housing?
Right. Her name is Vi Lyles, and that chapter was written by Dr. Andrea Benjamin, who's an associate professor of African American Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And she talked about the fact that she focused on economic development, the issues that they had because of an LGBTQ issue. And she talked about just the fact that, you know, Charlotte, because it's the Queen City, it's a world-class city, like every other large city, one problem that these women are all experiencing is just the fact that housing is no longer affordable in cities because these cities have gone through what we call gentrification in the sense that they've had to buy land in some of the poorer neighborhoods and transform those communities and turn them into communities where now affluent people live. And as a result of that, people who are poor who've lived in those cities all their lives are priced out. And so she has really come up with some ideas to try to bring about affordable housing. I think practically every woman in the book has had the same problem, especially in places like San Francisco. But they're trying to bring about affordable housing. But it's a really difficult thing to do because on one hand, if you don't gentrify an area, the area remains poor and blighted. But if you do practice gentrification, it ends up being something that's really disadvantageous to African-Americans, especially to poor people, and especially to older people. But she's really come up with some ideas about trying to bring about affordable housing in Charlotte.
Now, in Chapter 8, you talk about Chicago's previous mayor, Lori Lightfoot. Now, she didn't win any Black wards, and she didn't emphasize race. Tell us more about that.
Right. When she first ran, when she was elected, she wasn't reelected, of course. But when she ran for mayor, I think one thing that was interesting, there were several things interesting about Chicago. When she ran, she didn't win any of the Black wards. She ran in a runoff against a woman named Toni Preckwinkle, who is also an African-American woman. And that's really just outstanding. If you know anything about Chicago's history with machine politics and the Daily Machine, that two Black women would run in a runoff. And she was able to win because she won more support from white voters in 2019 than Toni Preckwinkle did. So she was not the Black community's choice when she ran. She didn't win any of the predominantly African-American wards. That was a chapter that was written by my good friend and colleague, Valerie Johnson, who's an associate professor of political science at DePaul University. And she's done extensive research on Chicago politics and on Lori Lightfoot. But yeah, that was something that was really interesting that she didn't was not the choice of Black voters. Very few African-American voters supported Lori Lightfoot. And she sort of won some of them over because when she ran for re-election, she then was able to win support among several of the predominantly Black neighborhoods. But it wasn't enough for her to be able to win because Chicago had so many problems with crime and policing and other types of issues that really I think that any mayor would have been, I won't say that she was overwhelmed, but I don't think anyone would be able to address problems of such a huge magnitude in one term. And so when she ran again, she won more support from Black voters, but she didn't win enough support from either Blacks or whites. And then this time, the white voters had sort of turned on her. And so she didn't win support among white voters when she ran for re-election. So that was something that was interesting. And it was uncommon because most of the women in the book have received a substantial amount of support from Black voters. And that was not the case with Lori Lightfoot.
Now you go to Atlanta and you start with Mayor Shirley Franklin and then Keisha Lance Bottoms. Tell us some of the issues that they had to deal with during these specific time periods.
Right. Shirley Franklin also was a very successful mayor, I would say. And I guess so was Keisha Lance Bottoms, even though she decided not to run for re-election. She would have been reelected easily, according to the polls, if she had, but she chose not to for various reasons. But in both situations, both of these women would probably go down in history as being among two of the more successful and also among the two of the more popular mayors in Atlanta. Shirley Franklin had worked in the administrations of previous black mayors in Atlanta. And so she had a lot of experience. And when she ran for mayor, she was elected and then she was reelected by a landslide. Keisha Lance Bottoms also had worked in government. She also had been involved in, she was a graduate of Florida A&M. She'd been involved in campus service, community service, as a member of Delta Sigma Theta. And both of them really heavily focused on economic development. But again, like the other cities, they had the same types of issues with housing and gentrification, especially Keisha Lance Bottoms. And like every other large city, they also had problems with crime because, you know, you can't talk about any large urban city without talking about crime. But they came up with some really innovative things as far as economic development, and especially with Shirley Franklin in terms of transportation. And they were able to achieve a lot during the times that they were serving as, both of the women were very successful during the time that they were serving as mayor.
Baltimore. Now, one fact that I read here was that both of the black females were plagued by incidents that forced them out of office. What happened right in Baltimore?
Yeah, there were three black female mayors in all, and two of them, Sheila Dixon and Catherine Pugh, both dealt with various types of problems in terms of fraud and other things that they were accused of, that basically that they were guilty of. And so in Baltimore, they had, of course, the Freddie Gray incident, which happened back in 2016. That was an African-American man who was telling the police that he couldn't breathe. But yet they, you know, basically they killed him anyway. And so that was an incident that Baltimore, unfortunately, will forever be known for. And with both women, especially with Catherine Pugh, there was a case in which, you know, there were gift cards that she was supposed to be using to help with helping poor people. And she was using them to buy things for herself. And this was something, I think the thing with both of these women is with both of the problems that they had, it received a lot of media attention. And so conservative media were able to really capitalize on this and capitalize on these problems that could have happened in any city. And I'm not saying that I'm trying to defend these women because I'm not, but they were able to make it seem like it was something that was a reflection of black women and black women's leadership. But both of these women had serious problems in Baltimore in the sense that both of them eventually left office in shame.
Now you move to Washington, D.C., and talk about two mayors there. The big problem, population decline and gentrification. Tell us about
it. Right. Yeah, both in this, these were the previous chapter. I forgot to mention the authors were Nadia Brown, Jamil Scott, and Christina Greer of the Baltimore chapter. And with this chapter on Washington, D.C., the author is Linda Troutman, who's an associate professor of political science at Ohio University. And she wrote about Washington, D.C. and focused on Sharon Pratt, who at the time that she was mayor was named Sharon Pratt Kelly, and the current mayor, Muriel Bowser. And she wrote about the same thing as problems that existed in other cities, with gentrification being a big problem in Washington, D.C. It's a very expensive city, like any other large urban city. Sharon Pratt had some different types of issues because she was still trying to serve in the Marion Barry era of Washington, D.C. politics. He remained popular, even though at the time he had gone to jail. He had been involved in this really embarrassing sting operation. And so Sharon Pratt came into office really at a disadvantage because I don't think anyone could have followed Marion Barry and could have gotten the kind of support or the kind of support that they needed, because he was still so popular. And at the time, the city still had a majority black population, and they really loved Marion Barry. Many people felt that he'd been treated unfairly. And so when she came into office, people already had a bias against her because she was a woman. And she also pointed out because she was a light-skinned woman and she was a small, petite woman that maybe that had something to do with it. And she was from an upper-class background and some people didn't like those things, according to her. So crime was really out of hand when she was in office in the 1990s. At one time, she even thought about inviting the National Guard in to help her because crime was that far out of hand, not just in D.C., but in major cities. And so that was the problem for Sharon Pratt. Just the crime rate was way out of hand in addition to other problems. And people didn't like her anyway. They wanted Marion Barry. And then eventually Marion Barry, even after she served, eventually he again was elected as mayor of Washington, D.C. And then Muriel Bowser has major problems with crime. A lot of these women have had to deal with COVID, of course. That was something that no one could have predicted would happen with housing and policing. And then also when President Trump was elected, Muriel Bowser, Keisha Lance Bottoms, Lori Lightfoot, several Black women had major issues with former President Trump. So those were the kinds of issues that she had to deal with.
Now, Chapter 12 deals with the Louisiana mayors. What were some of the commonalities that they were dealing with?
Right. In that chapter that I wrote with one of my former students, who is now in law school, but she was an undergraduate, and she was working with me through a program. We have the Bob S. Graham Center for Public Service at the University of Florida, and they have several programs, but she was a Preston Haskell scholar and she was doing research and she was so fascinated by the work, the readings that she was gathering for me that she asked me if she could work with me on the chapter. And I told her that she could. And so she was an undergraduate then, but she has since graduated. But in that chapter, we look at the mayor of Shreveport, the former mayor, Ollie Tyler, Sharon Weston Broome of Baton Rouge, and LaToya Cantrell of New Orleans. And we write about COVID and different types of issues that they had to deal with, the problems that they had during COVID with the governor, Brian Kemp. And a lot of the women had similar issues, especially Keisha Lance Bottoms. Oh, wait, I think I said Brian Kemp, but the governor of Louisiana isn't Brian Kemp. I meant Keisha Lance Bottoms had problems with the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp. But a lot of these women during COVID didn't want to reopen, but the governors of their state, they were Democratic governors, but they were Democratic mayors, but they had Republican governors who wanted the cities to reopen. And these women didn't want to reopen their cities because their cities still had high rates of COVID and a lot of deaths, especially among African-Americans from COVID. And so those were issues that women like Sharon Weston Broome and LaToya Cantrell had to deal with, in the sense that the governor of Louisiana wanted them to reopen their cities and they were refusing to. Keisha Lance Bottoms even ended up being a part of a lawsuit against the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, because he was wanting her to reopen the city and she was refusing to do so. So those were just some of the unforeseen circumstances that women, that mayors oftentimes have to deal with, that you just can't predict that there will be an international pandemic. And that's exactly what happened. And it had a huge impact in a lot of cities. And I talk about that, especially in the Louisiana chapter.
Now we move to San Francisco. She was from the public housing and there were lots and lots of Blacks that were moving out of San Francisco for over 50 years. So what was she dealing with and what is she dealing with now?
Right. That is the chapter on San Francisco that is on London Breed, who is having a very difficult time, and it's debatable as to whether or not she'll even be reelected. It was written by my friend and colleague, Dr. James Taylor, professor of political science at the University of San Francisco. And in that chapter, James has written extensively about San Francisco politics. As a matter of fact, he has a book that I can't wait to read that's coming out soon, in which he talks about Jonestown during the late 1970s when Jim Jones was this cult leader who led people from California to this in the middle of the jungle in Georgetown, Guyana, and renamed it Jonestown. And James is writing a book in which he talks about the political implications of the Jonestown tragedy, in which almost 1,000 people participated in a mass murder suicide. If you remember what happened back then, but in the San Francisco chapter, he mentions that, and he mentions the influence of Willie Brown, who was very powerful in California politics. London Breed, he talks about the fact that, of course, housing. When you think of a city where there is very expensive housing. San Francisco is one of the cities that you would think of in America. It's one of the most expensive places to live. So she has to deal with that, the traffic problems there, the homeless problems in San Francisco. And now even during the time that she's been in office, I think things have gotten worse in the sense that you're constantly seeing all of this negative media attention about businesses pulling out of San Francisco, especially the downtown area, because they don't feel that it's safe even to operate there. So those are the types of challenges that she has dealt with. London Breed grew up in San Francisco in one of the poorest communities. She has had a very troubled family life. She was raised by her grandmother. She had a sibling who died of a drug overdose, and you know, spent some time in jail. And yet she was able to earn her bachelor's degree, her master's degree, to work in government service. And later she became mayor. But even that was controversial because at first there was an effort sort of to keep her out of the mayor's position. She was entitled to be appointed as mayor after the death of the former mayor, Ed Lee. But they tried to keep her out of it. But eventually she ran for mayor and she was elected. But now her polling numbers are really low. And so now it remains to be seen as to whether or not she'll be reelected.
Chapter 14, the lessons learned from Black females. Tell us about what you found in the research.
Well, I found that in looking at and comparing Black female mayors to other mayors, male and female of different races, that, I mean, of course, as I mentioned, it's a very difficult job because there are so many things that there are so many different actors in cities that I think the average citizen doesn't think about just the fact that if you're the mayor, you're just one person and you have to work with so many different people in order to maintain law and order, in order to maintain prosperity. And it's a very difficult thing to do because not only do you have to attract businesses, but you have to keep the businesses who are currently there and convince them not to leave. You have to maintain crime and address the crime problem and maintain public safety. But that's difficult as well. And so there are so many different actors. And then people tend to focus on everything that you say, everything that you do. You have to almost be a perfect person. But the problem is that there's no such thing as a perfect person. So it's a really difficult job to do. And you have to really be a very strong-willed person to even want to do this job. But I think what we've shown in all of the chapters and looking at different cities from the north, south, east, and west, smaller cities and larger cities, even small towns, cities that have different racial makeups, different class makeups, that is a very difficult job to do. And you have to be a very strong-willed person to even be able to put together a campaign that's good enough for you to win, but then to be able to put together the kind of team and the kind of support that you need to be able to govern effectively, it's a very difficult job.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell us what is the next project you'll be working on?
Well, I'm already thinking ahead to a second edition because since we wrote this book, it was just published last year, there have been additional Black female mayors. At the time of the writing of the book, there wasn't a Black female mayor in Los Angeles, but now there is one. The mayor in St. Louis had just been elected. And so there are also situations where women who were elected weren't reelected. And so we want to try to look at those outcomes. But I'm already looking forward to having a second edition, and I'm already thinking about doing that because, again, my research mostly is on American mayors. So I'm really right now I'm primarily focused on having a second edition of the book.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that. And thank you again for being on the podcast.
Thank you. It was an honor.